Okay, thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for allowing me to speak. So because of time is sort of limited, I wanted to cover more things. We're going to tell you more about other things, but I won't get a chance to do that much. So what I'm talking about today was largely done, of course, by myself, and then my former student, Nick Weingartner, Ken Kelton, experimentalist in our department, and Flavio Nogueira, which so many of you know. And what I won't get a chance to talk about are sort of these papers. And I should note that this is actually a student. He's a fantastic student. So if he ever applies to any one of you, I highly recommend him. He's almost felt like a really great collaborator. But basically, we found out that you have quasi-crystalline structures when you have irrational doping. So if you look at many models, when you have irrational, or you have approximates, when you approach irrational numbers, and actually you have quasi-crystalline patterns that actually emerge. But I won't get a chance to talk about that much. What I will sort of talk about are galaxy features, or possible galaxy features. So as I guess many of you know and emphasized throughout the years, in strongly correlated electron materials, there's sort of a landscape of theories and of models and of results. So you can actually take a particular model, and I guess this is Steve and others emphasized, and tweak a bit the parameters, add additional terms, and so on, and you can get completely different results. So you can have a multitude of states which have almost identical energy densities, but display very different behaviors. On the other hand, of course, materials themselves have unique properties, and so on. So somehow we have this problem. We have lots of competing or intertwined possible states, and they're a very different character. The energy differences are very, very small. And unlike many sort of more conventional systems, we have to think about sort of nice soft modes and so on. In this case, it's not obvious if they exist, and if they do exist, it's not really clear what they are. So in the absence of sort of knowing what to do, at least for myself, it's nice to think about cases where the things appear elsewhere, where you can actually have a landscape of theories, not of string theories, but by the things that I actually understand much better. So, and actually from Steve, when I was a student many, many years ago. So actually all of these features appear in a very, very different sort of course, framework, but they appear, and have been going on for decades, if not centuries, in glasses. So in glasses you can have many, many states that have almost identical energies, and you know, and things are sort of really non-trivial, and there's a landscape of possible configurations you can actually have. So there's some sort of possible similarity that appears. And of course, saying it in words is one thing. Actually having results is a completely different thing. So what I'd like to do is sort of apply ideas, some simple ideas, really banal ideas, nothing profound. Calculations I'm going to do are really trivial, you would say, and you'd be absolutely correct. So apply sort of quantum ideas to the problem of glasses, both sort of classical glasses, structural glasses, and electronic glasses. The ideas are really trivial. So I would not be offended if you think about that way, because it really is. So that's my goal. My goal is sort of to look at sort of glasses, classical, quote-unquote, quantum, and so on, in sort of a general trivial quantum framework. And before I run out of time, which I will very, very shortly, let me tell you what my main conclusions sort of are. So one of the simple results is that if you have a variation of energy density, which of course means empirically in experiments, is if you vary temperature, you cool the system down or heat it up, but if you do it very sufficiently rapidly, then and you could also change pressure and fields, whatever you like to do, it's fine. If you change these parameters sufficiently rapidly and the system does not get a chance to equilibrate, then actually you have long-range correlations. You entangle them in a trivial way, and you have long-range correlations. They don't decay algebraically, exponentially, something completely different. It's, in a sense, it's a trivial result, as I'll show you later on, but it's nonetheless here. Okay, and sort of using this idea that you have long-range correlations, which I'll explain to you, hopefully, of course, in 25 minutes I have left or so, then you can have a very, very simple theory which tries to use that with one parameter which characterizes these correlations, one dimensionless parameter, which doesn't vary that much across different fluids, and sort of try to see if we can actually account experimental data. So what I've shown here is a the collapse that my former student, Nick Weingartner, did. And here are all the published, also unpublished data, but people, prior data was not available. All published data we can actually find on the viscosities of various fluids scaled on one curve, and this curve right here, which goes through them, is this curve which was used, this thing I just mentioned to you, with sort of a single parameter which accounts for these correlations.
This is all data of supercooled liquids?
Yes.
So these are all below their nominal freezing temperature?
Exactly.
And what's T1?
T1 is T liquidus, it's L. This is the melting temperature.
That's the melting temperature.
Exactly.
So A is your one parameter?
A is a dimensionless parameter, it's one parameter. Exactly. So maybe I should really explain in detail. I want to come to this later on, but let me, because you asked, Steve, let me sort of say this. So this is a dimensionless ratio, and what it is how far below you are in temperature relative to melting. So just to explain to all of you, I mean, because some of you have not probably worked on classes ever. So if you take any fluid, as far as we know, and you cool down fast enough, of course, what fast enough means is it depends on what the fluid is. But if you cool down fast enough, as far as we know, then you can actually enter, you can go below melting, you can supercool it. It's an unstable state, and you can keep going and going and going. As it supercools more and more and more, it becomes more and more rigid. It does not solidify in the usual way through crystal because it's supercooled, but it becomes ever more rigid. The viscosity becomes larger, becomes more sluggish, and so on. So this ratio right here is how far, it's not a reduced temperature, so similar to reduced temperature, it's how far away you are relative to melting or liquidus. As Steve mentioned, this is a dimensionless parameter, which for all these fluids here does not vary that much. It's going to about 0.07. It's there, but the standard deviation about 0.03 and so on, but it doesn't change that much. And what we plot here is a logarithm of viscosity at temperature T divided by viscosity at melting. So this is what you just measure. People measure force more precisely. And this, so the theory, of course, might be wrong or right. You know, if there's a good chance it's wrong. Hopefully it's not wrong, but it might be wrong. But the collapse speaks for itself. It's sort of, regardless of what the underlying reason is, all fluids that at least have published data, they seem to collapse into one master curve over 16 decades with only one parameter, which does not vary that much. If you would put here a reduced temperature, if you put here T melting, it would be a disaster. It would not collapse. So this change, which might seem innocuous, some T melting, usually reduced temperature relative to how far away you are below critical point and so on, if you reduce that to the actual absolute temperature, then it collapses beautifully. And the same thing also applies not for only viscosity, but also dielectric relaxation data. So you can actually have additional data from the relaxation measurements, other measurements. Again, if you collapse all those points together, so actually here we have different fluids, which are published data, and they again do the same thing, as you can see. And of course, there's some outliers. It's not always perfect. But you can sort of appreciate that these outliers are far in between. Most of these 66 fluids actually, they do collapse onto this curve. For whatever reason it happens to be, but they do collapse.
How do you measure viscosity of a supercooled?
There are many ways of doing it. The old-fashioned way is to take a sphere and drop it into a fluid and see how long it takes to fall down. And use Stokes' law. That's the old-fashioned way. Just look at terminal velocity. Now there are much better ways of doing it. You basically excite the mode in the fluid by applying fields. You can sort of measure how quickly it attenuates. That gives you, and you can film it very, very quickly and sort of see very in time frames exactly how it actually evolves. And from that, you can actually get a very, very accurate measurement of the viscosity. And there are other ways as well. But the old-fashioned way, also the easier way for conceptually to understand, to actually do some theoretical calculations. Not to use, of course, Cooper formalism, which of course is a formalism itself, but actually calculate for what you actually measure directly is what I mentioned to you earlier, this dropping sphere.
Where's water?
Water is here, but it I don't remember. Here it is, this one. And water, you can actually supercool fluid, you can supercool water in your freezer. You can actually take a bottle of water, pure water, without impurities. So, and you put it in the freezer in a plastic bottle, and you wait for about an hour. And after about an hour, you take it out of the freezer very, very gently, and you just So you don't tap it or anything like that. Just take it out very, very gently, and then you can sort of tap it then on the counter or pour it into a glass of into a glass. And as if you actually tap it or pour it into some container, then you will actually see it sort of ice form. So basically, it will be just super cool water. Some nucleation barrier that actually exists there, and by actually tapping it or dropping onto some hard surface, you can actually overcome that barrier. So now let's have to think about this as a quantum theory. As I mentioned to you, this theory is really rudimentary. There's nothing profound about it. The calculations are trivial, and so I'm not claiming anything profound. Let me just write down Hamilton, which we all know, but of course it's useless to actually write down because nobody can solve it. But nonetheless, it exists. So we have a many-body system. We have ions, we have electrons, we have Coulomb interactions, also other effects, if you want to include other effects. So there exists a theory of everything, of course, but it's, of course, as we all know, impossible to solve, but it exists. And the important thing about this theory is there's no disorder. So, and the same thing I've written here, of course, for the master theory of everything, you also take a more specialized theory you want to think about, if you would like to think about a more specialized theory, or a favorite theory. And this particular theory we have here, there's no disorder. So unlike spin glasses, in which you by hand impose disorder, because it exists a disorder that's imposed by hand, there's some impurities which are placed randomly and so on, here, in this God-given Hamiltonian, there's nothing that's imposed by hand as disorder. It's uniform. Okay? And that, of course, describes everything, but of course, it's useless to write down. But it exists. So now let's imagine that we had unlimited computer power at our disposal, and we can actually diagonalize this Hamiltonian. Of course, we can't. But allow me to fantasize that I would actually be able to diagonalize this Hamiltonian. I would have some spectrum. Okay, so it would be a very, very complicated spectrum. But nonetheless, it exists. And what I would like to do is to actually say things about the spectrum without solving a model. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is actually you could claim, and you can trivially prove that, that if you go to low enough energies, or energy densities more precisely, then all the states in the spectrum, on average, there might be deviations, and there will be deviations, localized states and so on, and conversely, but on average, these will correspond to solid equilibrium-type states. And on average, states at high enough energy densities, corresponding to temperatures which are high in equilibrium, high enough in equilibrium, will correspond, on average, to eigenstates have equilibrium-type properties. And there's also, of course, as you all know, when you go from solid to fluid or vice versa, there's also this coexistence region where you have both ice and water or generally a fluid and a solid coexisting. So, but nonetheless, before I get to that, let's visit this cartoon. There's this spectrum. It exists, okay? All I need is an existence. I don't actually need to actually know what spectrum really is exactly. So, as I just mentioned, even though I cannot solve this problem, for what I want to do, it's irrelevant, because I know in more than two dimensions, I have a phase transition, I have broken symmetries for these systems, and I have crystalline states and phonons and so on, temperatures below melting, and high enough energy densities, of course, I have a fluid. So how does this actually allow me to infer the quantum problem, infer the spectral problem, which can be applied, of course, for any empirical system, by using what you all know, and many of you taught your students, by just using an ensemble average. So if I take any quantity which I compute and measure in equilibrium for a conventional system, I don't have very, very long interactions with which ensembles are equivalent, I have to worry about things like that. So a typical conventional system, it doesn't matter what ensemble you use. You might as well use a microcanonical ensemble, which is the most precise one in some sense. And you can take any variable you actually want to think about, and calculate its average property. So if you have some observable O, and you want to calculate its average with energy E, then of course, as you all know, what you do is you look at some of all states, eigenstates, that lie in some energy window of arbitrary size delta E, which does not scale with system size. And you just average the value of O over those eigenstates, and that gives you the result. Usually, we tell our students to sort of find this from like oscillator, ideal gas, and so on, get some result, write the answer down for a homework problem or an exam, and so on. But of course, we don't always have to do it that way. We can actually go the opposite way. We can actually infer this from experiments. So even though this problem is not solvable, it doesn't matter. Experimentally, what you actually measure, our friends measure, corresponds to this. And from that, from the character of observables at the various energy densities E, I can infer the character of the eigenstates themselves. So I bypass the need to diagonalize or do anything fancy. I just can sort of let nature solve a problem for me. Which of course tells me now that if at high energy densities the system is a fluid, that means that on average, it's an average of course, on average the eigenstates describe the fluid. And if I have enough energy densities in the system as a solid, then on average the eigenstates describe a solid. Of course there can be outliers, but on average it's what will happen. So for instance, in high energy states I can have outliers which are anybody localized and vice versa, that's fine, but on average this is what will happen. Okay, so this is basically what I'm going to use. It's a trivial thing, but that's the thing I'm basically going to use. So I go back to this thing I sketched to you earlier, so I explained to you hopefully, or convinced you, or maybe it was obvious to you all along, why eigenstates here, and here you can infer their character from experimental measurements, and these states on average correspond to a fluid, these states on average correspond to a solid. These eigenstates here have a mixed character. They could display both the hallmarks of a solid and a fluid. Okay, so now let's think about the following experiment. Suppose I start off in equilibrium at high temperature. It doesn't have to be this way. You can think about any way that you'd like to. But just allow me to think about a particular scenario. You can think about any way that you want to do. You can think about doping and so on. But in this setup, let's imagine we start off from a system at high temperatures or high energy densities. In equilibrium, which means that energy density interval that I occupy is sharp. So any dynamic equilibrium, all variables, all intensive state variables, have a very well-defined sharp value, which goes like 1 over n, 1 over squared of n, depending on what ensemble you like. But the important thing is it's sharp. Okay, so basically, the dynamic limit, all these quantities are sharply defined. Basically, you have a delta function describing my distribution at high densities in equilibrium. Suppose now I cool the system down. What happens is if I remain in equilibrium, this delta function, this very, very narrow Gauss, whatever it would happen to be, would remain very, very narrow. I would have well-defined, sharp quantities I would measure, but it doesn't always have to be very, very sharp, and that's what I want to emphasize here. Okay, so that's basically what I'm aiming at. Okay, so let's really do this experiment, so to speak. So imagine that, and this is just words about, you know, that you can have broken symmetries and so on, and I should sort of say that if you have no broken symmetries apart from the conventional ones, then basically, all these states that appear at low temperatures are just related by translation and rotations and so on, the usual geometries we're accustomed to. So we can use them to expand anything we want to think about. So suppose I start from this initial state, okay? So this is, again, this is just trivial. I'm writing down it in this language, but really, of course, trivial. So suppose I have some initial state, psi initial. It's a many-body state. You might say, well, you shouldn't use wave functions because you have density matrices. You're absolutely right. The same thing would apply. The symmetries, nothing changes. Just easier to write it down this way. Suppose I start from the initial state of this many-body system, and I do it to whatever I want to do. I lower temperature down, or apply pressure, whatever I want to do to it. So I can think about this as applying an evolution operator, obviously, to my initial state. Okay. In the case I'm describing right now, this evolution operator, of course, does not commute to the Hamiltonian. Otherwise, of course, energy would not change. So this evolution operator U is such that whatever I have here, at least in some intermediate times, cannot commute with H, because otherwise, of course, the spectrum would be, the initial state would have the same energy in the end. But now whatever I have at the end, I have some state psi at the end, whatever that state is, however complicated it might be, I can always express it in terms of the complete eigenstates of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so again, I don't have to know how to diagonalize a problem. The important thing for me is to know that this set, this complete set of eigenstates, from this complete basis, they can expand any wave function on that basis, including, of course, what happens after I cool the system down. So I can write the state.
If you do it that way, then you have to achieve supercooling by changing a parameter of the Hamiltonian, because you have no temperature
absolutely.
Of the labels, right?
You can do it in a variety of ways. You can change the parameter of Hamiltonian. You can actually couple it with some external bath, prepare some initial special state, and then because the state is special, you can actually evolve and such things will change. Absolutely. So you have, so if it's a closed system by itself, you have to change Hamiltonian. And if it's an open system, then the thing it's coupled to in the end can be fixed, but of course you have some initial state.
At the end, you're going to return to the same Hamiltonian you started.
It depends on, you can do it, you can do it in a variety of ways. So one way is that, which is the easiest way, but you can also do it in other ways. But the easiest way is basically what you both just said. So you can imagine that you have a Hamiltonian, just think, make it the simplest possible thing, have a Hamiltonian for the system, I change some parameters, describe whatever I want to do to it, I turn them up or down, it go back to where I was, and that's my final
state. Change the mass or something like this.
Whatever you want, whatever you'd like to do, you can do to it. Of course, it's easier to say it theoretically than experimentally, but just you can imagine doing that, which would correspond to tweaking this Hamiltonian such that whatever happens to it, happens to it. Whenever I have it at the end, it can expand now on this complete eigenbasis. Now, of course, this is useless to write down because it's always true, it's a tautology. But it's not completely useless on second thought, because as I described to you earlier, or reminded you, depending on how you want to think about this, these states here have a well-defined character. So if I occupy states, eigenstates, of high enough energy density, rho is a correspondence, particular case, to fluids, and if I occupy states fine amplitudes that correspond to densities, will correspond to the solid type eigenstates. Okay? And I have now an admixture of these states. In general, of course, usually it's just one of the other, it's just sometimes very, very sharp. But more generally, there's nothing, there's no theorem that tells you, oh, it has to be sharp. And that's my main point. You can have this intertwined, you can have this coexistence of different multiple states that can have either very, very close energies or different energies, depending on the case at hand. That's really sort of the main idea. It's a trivial idea, of course. I mean, you can call it an idea, but that's the main point. So regardless of what you actually do to it, it doesn't matter. You can expand, okay? So you can do a setting with density matrix. I want to take your time for about that, because I want to have time for Catherine.
Can I ask maybe a stupid question? So where does entropy come into the game? Well, these transitions, let's say from solid to liquid, and they typically involve a change in entropy, right? It's not the energy itself that has the character as a transition, right? You need to play up one against the other.
So it all comes. I mean, so of course, in the last few years, it's been, of course, older than that. But in the last few years, of course, this many-body localization and eigenstate formalization hypothesis sort of came more to life than it used to be a decade ago. But you can calculate anything that you want also for a single eigenstate. You can actually define an entropy for a single eigenstate, of course. You can define internal energy in this trivial way. You can define also any phenomenon considerable for it as well.
So maybe to sharpen the question, you are implying that you can distinguish between, let's say, liquid and solid states by looking at the energy only, right?
So you can use a variety of variables. So empirically, as you know, if you vary temperature, so if I would vary only with energy itself or temperature, temperature energy density, then I would actually go, I must go from a fluid to a solid. There's no way around it. Yeah. And of course, these states are also characterized by other observables as well. So if I work in the macroionical ensemble, for instance, where my state variables are just number of particles, volume, and energy, then and I keep the number of particles fixed, the volume does not change. I imagine doing it that way, or my simulation do it that way if you want. I change the energy itself, so in that case I go from the fluid to the solid or vice versa as I vary the energy itself.
Let's talk about it.
Okay. Okay. So you got the idea. So in general I would actually have a distribution of these guys, and this distribution would actually the norm squared of course would correspond to probabilities that I occupy states of either kind. In this case fluid or solid, but it can be more complicated situations. That you have different states that you think about, they have different characteristics and so on, nothing will change there. It's the same exact idea. Okay? So now, coming back here to this question of, I'm now flashing for a third time, or actually fourth time, I don't know that very quickly, but if I have something very, very, very sharp, it has a very, very clear character, whichever the equilibrium. But if you have something which is sort of smeared, and you might ask me, how can this possibly be? Because we know from textbooks it's impossible and so on. But we'll get to that momentarily. If you have something which is sort of smeared and has some finite width, then in that case, the wave function, or corresponding density matrix in the general setting, will actually include states which will either be fluid-like, and states will be solid-like, and also possibly states that are of mixed character. Okay, so now if I calculate anything that I want, I'll have to take into account the results that I'm having for these states, and of course, terms that have the off-diagonal terms between them, and so on, if they exist. Okay, that's my main point. So the width need not be zero. Okay, it will be. So what I'm plotting here is amplitude squared. It's some real numbers, a probability, of course, probably density. It could be anything up here. Usually it's a delta function, and your density is well defined, but it doesn't have to be that. Now, of course, if we have something which is adiabatic and do things very, very slowly, of course, and things are in equilibrium, everything is ideal, textbook type stuff, and so on, then the distribution, of course, remains a delta function. But in real life, things don't necessarily happen that way, especially if we have supercool things rapidly. And obviously, it's out of equilibrium. And the only way it could be out of equilibrium is either that you have some broadening, and this is not longer sharp, and therefore you have deviations from what you actually calculate, assuming that this is very, very sharp. Or you have special states, which people thinking about many localizations do. Or both, of course. But there's no way around it. Either this or that, or both things at the same time.
You could have multiple states.
You can have multiple states. You have degeneracies, of course. You can have related by rotation and translations and so on.
Yes. Solid states.
Yes.
Here
you can actually have coexistence.
Out of equilibrium could be they are simply in the wrong set.
Yes,
you may have
absolutely.
Many more liquid states, but you're still stuck to the solid ones.
Yes.
The other way around.
But the important thing is that these form a complete basis. And in the usual case, I just average over all states of a given energy density. And of course, you might say, well, only some states are important. So by some miracle, when I cool the system down, I only think about those special states because they're very, very important. It's an ideal glass or whatever it is. But if I don't think about special states, I think democratically that anything can actually happen, then these states, and of course all the states generated with them, are occupied more or less uniformly with some probabilities which are of order, which are more or less equal and so on, at high energy densities. And low energy densities as well, but now low energy densities, what happens if I cool the system down very, very quickly, I actually could potentially actually broaden and have a coexistence of different phases. I mean, or states more precisely in this particular. So they're intertwined, but in a trivial sense, basically it's a superposition. Okay, so I'm not using the word in the proper sense, but just superposition of these states. Okay. Now you might say this is nonsense, because how can it possibly be? Because we teach our students that it has to be sharp, because otherwise you get paradoxes and so on. I don't have time, and I don't want to take your time either. But actually, it's not true. What we teach our students, and all the theorems we teach our students and so on, they typically derive equilibrium systems. Actually, if you do things very, very quickly and change some control parameter rapidly, there's no theorem that guarantees that things will remain sharp. In fact, you can actually prove it will not be true. You can actually prove that things will not be remain sharp. So one proof, amongst others I've been able to come up with, is just using uncertainty relations. You can actually think about, as you asked me earlier, if you can vary one parameter in some Hamiltonian or couple it to some larger bath and so on. So what I can actually do is I can think about a two Hamiltonian system, one describing my small system and one describing this larger system, the small inclusion I have of the small. So basically like a canonical ensemble, which I derive from having a small system which sits inside, coupled to some heat bath, and the whole thing together can be described macrocanonical ensemble. So I have two systems and two Hamiltonians, which are corresponding to these A's and B's. Of course, this relation, of course, is general, as you all know. But in this particular case, we can apply it to a macrocanonical ensemble, describing my whole closed system, for which, if a system actually equilibrates at long times, and of course, the variance does not change as a function of time if it's closed, it must have energy density which is sharp, and macrocanonical ensemble, in fact, this is of order.
Delta one. E is energy density or energy?
No, it's energy. So delta E itself, so this is capital E, and then I have small e. So delta E, large E, is energy twiddle of a large system. Maybe the whole is a small subsystem plus larger, plus the heat bath of the environment. That's described by H twiddle, and H without twiddle will describe just the Hamiltonian of the subsystem itself. Okay, so the macrocanonical ensemble, of course, the uncertainty that I have in E itself is of order 1. The important thing is it does not scale system size. That's the important thing. And now if I just apply the usual, this uncertainty relation, which you all know, I just do the usual thing, there's nothing profound about it, and I just get the usual time uncertainty relation, time energy uncertainty relation, and so on. But now the only difference is that we have two Hamiltonians. We have one which is a small system and one of a larger system. And now, because the larger system has an uncertainty which is of order one, and because if you vary the energy at a constant rate, which is finite, so the energy of the system varies such that its energy density varies, temperature drops at a finite rate, it's not zero. So this quantity right here has a modulus, derivative of energy of the system itself, this scales as n, which means that this thing scales as n. So during cooling itself, the same thing can be applied for anything you want, any other parameter you want to think about, there's nothing special about cooling, that you have a spread in energies, which is of order n. So the energy density is not sharp. Okay, so what we teach our students is not always correct, and we have to be slightly more, even though of course it's always correct in all usual cases, but the matter is not always correct. So of course what typically happens is you cool it down, wait for a short time, it equilibrates. How short do you have to wait? It depends on the system at hand. So as I guess many of you know, you can actually rigorously, this was done actually now a few times over, so there's a paper by Tasaki from 2013, there actually other papers as well. If you wait a time scale of order h bar over kt, that you can actually, for random initial states, you will actually equilibrate at that time scale. In reality, you have energy barriers and so on, but the important thing is typically make it doesn't require a long time to equilibrate. So you initially have a large, you might have a large variance, but if you wait long enough, and that long enough is not necessarily really that long, energy density restores to a sharp defined value. Okay, so energy density goes to a sharp value, but it doesn't always have to be. It's possible where you can actually get stuck in some state and you cannot actually restore a sharp value of energy density. And that's what I claim can actually suggest happens in class. I don't want to take time from Catherine, so I'll just say that you might say that this is the argument is misleading, it's just algebra and you don't know what you're talking about, and so on. I'm not saying that you said it. I'm just saying that you might think about it in this way. So of course you can always write down toy models, which we all love to do as theorists. And you can sort of see what happens. So one toy model makes many others you can concoct. You can concoct many of them in one dimension, two dimensions. But let's make it really, really simple. So one trivial example amongst many is the following. Suppose I start a Fermionic system. So all these coupling constants are positive, okay? The spin 1/2. Of course, you all know this system. And this dot product between two spin 1/2s, as you all know, corresponds up to trivial rescaling in addition. Permutation between two spins. Okay, so SI with SJ corresponds to half a permutation operator between spins I and J minus a quarter. So that means any state that has maximal spin, S total is equal to maximal value, is trivially, of course, an eigenstate of this term. Right? Because any term, any state of maximal spin is completely symmetric, does not change under the permutation operator. So it's, of course, an eigenset of this term. And if you take a well-defined value of Fz, I suppose I define as the axis to be 1 parallel to h, any state of this form of maximum spin, if I have n spins, is n over 2, having any value of S total, that's an eigenstate of this Hamiltonian. It's, of course, a trivial statement. This is any dimension and so on, any graph, and whatever you want to think about. This is, of course, a very special set of states. Of course, you have 2^n possible states here, of which only of order n are these states. I have to stop some. Yeah, okay. So basically, what I'm trying to say is that you can actually write these states down, you can evolve them, you can apply a transverse field and so on. You can do it other variety of ways. You can pick your favorite way of doing it. Everything is local here. I'm not treating by having anything long range and so on. And what you find is the energy density actually has a value. Forget about the actual numbers here and so on. I didn't define them yet. But the important thing is that actually the energy of variance is of order one. Okay, so and the time to actually achieve that does not scale system size. There's no Liebig-Robinson bounds or anything like that. It's just some number which scales as one itself. So in a very short time interval, actually, the variance actually already becomes, or the energy itself becomes extensive, energy density becomes of order one. Okay, and you can do this for other models. You can actually map these to Hartree bosons and so forth. Hartree bosons have the same thing and so on. So you can do it in many, many different cases, which actually correspond to doping. You can actually apply this thing to doping. And in that case, of course, you have even though the number of particles is sharp, so the average value of n at any site is the same, you have a variance of n. So, but I don't have time, so I don't want to and then we'll take time from Catherine. So basically, the important point is that you can actually calculate any observable using this formula in a trivial way. You can just write down what these are, do a long-time average. Okay, these integrals become delta functions in the usual way. And what happens is that you have to get diagonal to elements. So to cut to the chase, what happens is if you calculate any observable long times, you'll just find it's equal to what you have at long times, what you have in equilibrium weighted with different probabilities. So what I'm trying to say is, okay, let me just go one just here. Anything that you measure, this is a fancy way of writing it down. Forget about this fancy stuff. All I'm saying is that the average, any observable, at long times, this is long time average, can written down what you have in equilibrium when weighed with different energies, energy isotopes. If you have additional quantum numbers, I can sort of the sum of those and so on. So basically, what you have is that you have to mix together these averages in these coexisting phases, if they appear, because you have this broadening. And now you can actually apply this to the viscosity. So how do you measure viscosity? This was actually, of course, asked earlier by Victor. So of course, you don't use a couple formalism to actually calculate viscosity mentally. What you do is actually what I described to you earlier. You take a sphere, one other thing you can actually do, drop it into a bucket, look at its terminal velocity. Terminal velocity has been known for a very long time, of course. It's a Stokes-Einstein relation. So terminal velocity of a sphere is just given by some numerical constants, difference in mass densities, and most notably here, the dimensions of the sphere itself, and most notably, on the viscosity of the fluid. So if you measure this, then you know the viscosity. Now you can now take this operator I described earlier to be the velocity of this dropping sphere, you can apply this equation to it. Okay, and what you actually get is that you just have what you would have in equilibrium at the energy density E, weighted with probability of occupying different energy densities. And now if you assume that this is a Gaussian because you want to maximize the entropy with fixed variance, which is not zero, so it's an assumption. It's only an assumption, actually. And do an integral. So take this to be a Gaussian, do an integral, get an error function, okay? The width of the Gaussian is scale-free, it's conformal, it's set by temperature itself, and then you just get this expression, and that's the expression I plotted in the beginning. So this thing here I showed you earlier just corresponds to that. So this is ultra-fanal, this is when they're fluids, when the canonical, very so-called fragile fluids that I learned about from Steve and his father when I just started working with Steve many, many years ago. And you see the viscosity of this ultrafanal changes dramatically over many decades and so on. It's a feature of many fragile glass formers, of which this is an archetypical example. And this fit, of course, fits very, very well with the value of A bar, which is basically 5%. And the same thing can be applied to all the fluids I showed you. And up here, I probably have to stop. So this is from the beginning, okay? This is the same thing now with also dielectric data and so on. So here I have to stop, and the conclusion is basically just Arvid. I showed this for glasses, structural glasses, but of course there's nothing special about, structural glasses are fascinating. But insofar as this formula is concerned, there's nothing special about structural glasses. It can be applied to anything. So if you apply if you change some parameter quickly, then you have a spread. The spread typically goes to zero very, very quickly in most systems, but it doesn't have to. If it doesn't, you have an admixture of possible states, and when you measure and calculate, it will be reflected in that. And that's where I have to stop.
We're running a bit late, but are there questions or comments, discussion?
Can I just ask, when you say mobility edge, you're saying a quantum mobility edge for the atoms?
Mobility edge in a sense that so not an unusual sense, but in a sense of that these states, I probably should go here a lot backwards, but just the intuition of many of us who worked in other systems. So these states here, are sort of are not localized, in the sense that you can actually have transport.
Don't
you worry. So maybe the word was not used in the proper.
A single particle, it's quantum Hamiltonian of atoms.
Right, so the mobility edge in the sense that here you actually have flow, hydrodynamic flow. This is more of an analogy. And here you have no flow. So here there's flow, you can push water or whatever it flows. In ice, it does not flow. So it's not in the level that you think about, just because it comes to us, make one body and so on. This is what I'm trying to say.
So I'm confused about many things you said, but let me ask one specific question. Somehow or other, you're asking us to think about supercooled liquids from a quantum mechanical point of view.
Yes.
And, okay, I guess you have every right to do that. The real supercooled liquids are certainly quantum mechanical. But are you saying there's something intrinsically quantum mechanical about the...
Yeah, so you can write this now, as I mentioned in passing earlier, classically. But you can basically think about microstates and phase space, and instead of having a well-defined shell and how it's smeared out and so on, you can do that. But it's not as clean as it actually is quantum mechanics.
I mean, I certainly know that people do numerical
measurements hard
on classical.
Of course, but it's really hard to get results which are slow enough.
Well, okay.
So I'm not saying that this is what's required. I'm just saying that empirically, to actually get results in real time, it's pretty hard to do. There are some ways of doing it for special cases where you can actually do permutations and so on. You can even do it faster than in real life. So we actually have one nice example that's been around for the last year, actually, by Ludovic Berthier, which you might know, and so on, and others, actually, is to think about it. A system has many, many components, A, B, C, D, and so on. And what you do is you run a simulation, and at random times you permute, if it's physically allowed, different species. So you permute A with C and B with Z and so on. And the permutation, of course, are done on the computer. It cannot happen when you evolve it in real life. And they speed up things considerably. So you actually can actually beat nature in that. But in reality, it's very, very hard to get glasses. And it's especially to get, of course, really, really long times, as for obvious reasons, it's really hard.
Yeah, I agree with you, but nonetheless, you do simulations, yeah, you see the viscosity grow by 4 or 5
orders of magnitude. The question is how. And the question is really how.
Yeah, you see super Arrhenius groups.
And of course, as I said before, you can cast this also classically, even though I think it's a bit of a cheat in some sense, but you can do this classically. You place the sums by integrals over phase space, and so on. Imagine basically.
Okay, so
you can do it.
You're saying quantum mechanics is a convenience.
It's a convenience, and it's more of a convenience for electronic systems. I didn't talk about it here, but where of course more relevant.
All right. Any other? Okay. Great. So.